Schubert's Duo in A was played by Veronika Eberle with the pianist Oliver Schnieder. And that's the end of this programme featuring our new generation artists. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 7 o'clock. Time now to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom, which is presented by Penny Gore.
Well, welcome to the Royal Albert Hall at the culmination of another choral Sunday at the BBC Proms. And tonight the stage is as packed, I think, as I've ever seen it for an oratorio that had its first performance in Birmingham in 1846, Mendelssohn's Elijah. Conductor Paul McCreesh has been hard at work on this much-loved masterpiece with the ensemble he founded, the acclaimed Gabrielli Consort and Players. And they're joined here by four distinguished soloists in the title role, baritone Simon Keenly side, soprano Rosemary Joshua, mezzo Sarah Connolly and tenor Robert Murray. On the platform with them are the Wrocław Philharmonic Choir from Poland and a plethora of young choral singers from no fewer than four different choirs from all corners of the UK. The Taplow Youth Choir, Ulster Youth Chamber Choir, Cheetham's Chamber Choir and the North East Youth Chorale. For Paul McCreesh, Elijah is a work ripe for reassessment.
Maybe the time has come for Mendelssohn and Elijah. You know, composers do go up and down in fashion. And Mendelssohn had a terribly bad press for so much time. I think he's a composer that it's very easy to over-sentimentalise. I think he's an absolute genius. He's a great revolutionary. But I think the style of which he created was very quickly taken over by the Victorians and a whole host of rather ghastly 14th-rate composers and became very gooey and flabby. And I think Mendelssohn is the last of the classicists as much as one of the great nascent romantic composers.
Paul McCreesh, who will be conducting the revised version of the oratorio made by Mendelssohn for performance in London in 1847, a year after the premiere. But the orchestra replicates the massive forces on hand for Elijah's debut at the Birmingham Triennial Festival.
Birmingham was absolutely determined to outdo anything else you could hear in the whole empire. You know, they were clearly as proud of their triennial festival as they were of Simon Rattle a century later. And you can smell that. I mean, for example, the programme has every single player's name in, some of the great virtuosi of the day, and where they come from, this sense of celebrating, and all the rules for the chorus singers. And the very first performance was one of the great triumphs. It was even reviewed in rehearsal. That'd be a scary thought, isn't it? you know, the expectation was extraordinary. We have exactly the same size orchestra that Birmingham used, which is enormous. It's about, I don't know, 140, 150 people. Doubled trumpets, single horns, single trombones, doubled woodwind, huge string orchestra. And then instruments that you won't normally see, ophicleides, which were tripled, including a very rare instrument called the Monstre ophicleide, the Monster ophicleide, and that is exactly what it is. And there is only one left in the world, and we've flown it in at rather inconsiderable cost, not to the licensed pair, I hasten to add, from New York State. The man who owns it, Ron Johnson, has been incredibly kind and lent it to us. So we're playing that, for only the second time it's ever been heard in the UK. We also have serpents, which is interesting, this curly woodwind instrument shaped, as you imagine, like a snake, which plays with the bass section. And, of course, the Royal Albert Hall organ, which is only 24 years, I believe, if I've got my dates right, later than the premiere. Very, very close to the time. And William Whitehead, who's playing organ today, is actually, except for one particular moment, only going to use the Victorian pipes.
Paul McCreesh. Well, we'll be hearing Elijah's voice, sung by Simon Keenly's side, right at the start of the work, even before the overture, declaiming a dramatic prophecy that God has ordained drought to be causing famine in the land. That's the start of the chain of events that unfolds in part one of Elijah. Coming on stage now are the soloists, Simon Keenly's side, Sarah Connolly, Rosemary Joshua and Robert Murray, with treble Jonty Ward leading the way, and Paul McCreesh taking his place on the podium to begin tonight's proms performance of Mendelssohn's Elijah.
Thank you. transgressions the prophet Elijah has seen at the heavens through the word of God. I therefore say to ye, forsake your idols, return to God, for he is slow to anger and merciful and kind and gracious. Find him. My God.
fulfilled. I will show myself unto Ahab. Your forest gods and mountain deities.
They'll be cries me, hear and answer us. Thank you. trumpets of bell, and let not one of them escape you. Bring them down to Kyson's brook, and let them be
Breaketh the rock, that breaketh the rock. Oh, Lord, my God.
part one of Mendelssohn's Elijah, ending with the people turning to God as Elijah calls down a storm to end the drought that blights the land. Simon Keenly's side is Elijah, with the soprano Rosemary Joshua in a role originally written for the Swedish Nightingale Jenny Lind, the mezzo Sarah Connolly, the tenor Robert Murray, and the treble John T. Ward. And that great cheer is for him as he takes a solo bow. Great evening for him here on the stage of the Royal Albert Hall with this mighty assemblage of performers. Paul McCreesh conducting the Gabrielli Consort and Players with a dazzling array of young choral talent. The Taplow Youth Choir, the Ulster Youth Chamber Choir, Cheatham's Chamber Choir, the North East Youth Chorale, and the Wrocław Philharmonic Choir. 300 singers on stage in all. And William Whitehead plays the organ of the Royal Albert Hall, which you probably heard rumbling majestically away at various points in the first half of the piece. Well, after all the drama of part one, part two follows in 20 minutes, during which time we've something a little different. Quakers Don't Sing takes us far away from the massed choral forces which Mendelssohn assembled for his great Old Testament epic. But it's a curious coincidence that just around the corner from where Elijah was first performed in Birmingham is the area of Bourneville, a Quaker model village set up with an alternative ethos to life and worship. Many creative people have found a spiritual home amongst the Quaker movement in our noisy modern world, but one thing seems to be missing from this most peaceful of all gatherings: music. Dame Judi Dench, novelist Margaret Elphinstone, and composer Sally Beamish contribute to a montage of thoughts akin to a Quaker meeting and reveal their own relationships with silence and music.
I'm Sally Beamish, and most of my life is spent in and around music. I write music for a living. And silence is something that I realise is very important to me. In fact, I find that going for a walk or going for a run is actually working time. It's time when ideas seed themselves and develop. And in fact, a quiet walk before I start work is often what I need to do to clear my mind. It's always been a very important thing. And the danger is always, of course, to think I've only got a certain amount of time to work and then just try and start writing music straight away. And it's interesting the number of times when I've been sitting in the Quaker meeting and I realise I'm working, and it's because of the silence, which has taught me to turn it round the other way and to start my work with that quality of silence, if I can, and get rid of the panic.
Well, I'm Margaret Elphinstone, and I'm a novelist, and I would say my relationship to silence has been a long and comfortable one. I think silence is a very important part of writing. I'm not a musician. Music has been an important part of my life. And the relationship between silence and music, when I started thinking about this, I realised there's quite a lot of connection there for me. But coming into the Quaker silence, I didn't have to say whether or not I was Christian, or I didn't have to say anything. And it seemed a continuum with the way that silence had been for me before, which is a place of strengthening and upholding, I think.
I'm Judi Dench, and I went to a Quaker boarding school in York, primarily because I liked the uniform, but it turned out to be very fortuitous that I did go there, because within a very short time, really, well, I suppose I went when I was 13, 14. And within a year or 18 months, I just found that the whole ethos of Quakerism suited me very, very well. I think I've always imagined that I have an unquiet soul, because once I'd been introduced to the whole business of sitting in a meeting and waiting and just being there quietly with a group of other people, I found that that was very good for me and really beneficial. You know, I actually felt better after being in meeting. And I love going to church and have always gone to church with my families. So, I mean, I love that and I love choral singing, but I always feel that it's done for you a bit in church, that you have to make more of an effort about sitting in a meeting. And, of course, your mind wanders into other directions and you don't concentrate. But then what you do is to acquire a discipline of concentration. And that seems to me to be, well, a good thing for me.
In writing, I write from silence. I write often, if I can, in places where I'm alone, where it's quiet. But I'm also, and people comment on this, I find it quite easy to enter my own silence. In other words, I've never had a difficulty with concentration. That as long as nobody's making emotional demands of me or expecting me to take responsibility for what's around me, I can ignore it. You know, I can write on a train, I can write in a house with a lot of people. There's a silent space inside the noise. And when one is absolutely focused on what one is doing, what one's writing, or the world one is in, I mean, I know, for example, never ever to put a pot of anything on to boil and go and start writing, because it will burn. It is that silent space outside one's normal life that when I'm writing, I go into, and even if it's not literally silent around me, I'm writing from my own silence. My novel Voyageur is a novel in which I decided to address my Quaker tradition, and it's about a young Quaker man in 1811, 1812, who makes a long journey. He's a Quaker from the heartland in Cumbria, Cumberland as it was then, and he goes to North America. In fact, he's looking for his sister who was lost in the ministry. One of the intriguing things that it was very common in those days for women to travel alone, in pairs, but two women, giving Quaker ministry. And she has disappeared somewhere beyond the settled frontier in Upper Canada. And he goes looking for her. And he finds himself in the middle of a war, which is the 1812 war between Canada and the United States. So I put a Quaker in the front line, quite literally, of one battle. And I just see what he does with the peace testimony and with other testimonies, including the one we're discussing here, things like art, music, and so on. And there's a point in the novel where he finds he's singing one of the songs that the voyageurs have been singing on their journeys by canoe up through the Canadian rivers. And he thinks, is this a sin? And then he thinks, I'm feeling so good, it can't be. That's what the novel is about, is his engagement with the outer world. And he's brought into the world. He has to. Can he keep his Quaker beliefs and integrity? Is there anything left? And how does his peace testimony in particular be upheld in a noisy world full of war?
I passed more clearings and more cabins. And then I came to a place where the fields were not surrounded by dense forest, but separated from their neighbours by rough-hewn log fences. The harvest was in. The stubble fields looked smooth as a spread blanket. I came to a copse of trees, and just beyond it a house whose windows were filled with lamplight, set back a little from the road. It was so surprising that I stepped up very quietly and looked in the window, standing within the little warm circle of light, feeling the chill of the dark against my back, breathing in the unfamiliar smells of the forest night. A dozen friends were gathered on the first three rows of benches. For a moment, the meeting house seemed filled with a heavenly radiance. A meeting for worship in the manifest light of God's presence. But I banished such a flight of fancy, still unfledged. In Moorsdale, with thrifty folk, we don't use four great lanterns to light one small meeting. Our meeting house is old and damp, built of Lakeland slate, with little windows and oak benches darkened by the years. Here, the wood was pale and new, the roof high, and the space below airy and light. There were no dark shadows or unlit corners, nor damp streaks on the walls or mouldy patches. Never before, in fact, had I seen so modern and commodious a meeting house. The floor was of wooden boards, which must be an unconscionable comfort to the feet on winter mornings. The empty benches around the little gathered meeting could have accommodated upwards of 50, and that, I realised shortly, was only in the men's meeting. For, when I peered in the next lit window, I saw I was at the other side of a wooden partition that divided the meeting house in two, and on this side there were perhaps 20 women in caps and grey cloaks, also gathered in the silence. I found the door to the men's meeting, opened it quietly, and crept to a bench at the back, where I took my place in the gathered meeting. I unlaced my gaiters, took off my clarty boots, and left them at the door, and returned to my corner, where the little draughts crept around me and pierced my sodden breeks and stockings. I did my best to ignore the grumbling in my belly, for I'd eaten nought but cheese and clapbread since I left York, but closed my eyes and gave sincere thanks to God for bringing me safe through the wilderness this day unto this remote haven of my own people.
I remember as a child going to Quaker meeting and feeling a sensation almost as if I was on a boat with a lot of other people, that you were on the same boat together and travelling somehow in the same direction, but still remaining very much as individuals and with individual thoughts and feelings, but that the boat was going the same way somehow. Another thing I noticed as a child was the way the meeting would take on a theme, so that someone might speak after 15 minutes or so of silence, and then maybe 10 minutes later someone else would speak, but obviously everyone's thoughts had been redirected by the first person that spoke. So the meeting would take on a kind of theme, and that's something which I think is very often the case.
People say you sit in silence. You do in fact sit in silence, though it's sometimes quite clamorous. And then somebody will get up and say something. And you realise it's not a silence at all. It's a silence, certainly, of a lot of people coming together and that very silence creating something of substance.
The silence gathered. I felt the peace of the Lord like a garment wrapped around, protecting us from the uncharted wilderness without. I leaned back against the wall and shut my eyes. I'd walked nearly 30 miles that day, which would have been a small matter in my own country. But here, the forest seemed to have thrust its way into my mind, so that when I shut my eyes, I saw only the line of trees, the patch of sky above the road, and the shining puddles in the mud. In my mind, I still trudged on, and when I came back to myself at last, Amos Armitage had me by the shoulder and was shaking me. "Do the elders of Cumberland give a man leave to sleep in meeting, friend?" "But thee hast travelled far, and may be forgiven. Come with me, and we shall see what we can do for thee."
What I think you learn about the discipline of silence and sitting in silence is that you learn about listening. And listening is a vital thing in our profession. You know, you have to listen to what another actor is saying to you. You have to listen because sometimes that slightly changes, therefore your answer will be in a different form. So listening is very, very much a part of what our training is.
I think the violin concerto is my angriest score. It's slightly uncharacteristic of the way I normally write. It's quite abrasive. And I just wanted to depict that absolute horror of the First World War. And in fact, it's a piece that doesn't really resolve. It ends as angrily as it began. There's a central movement which comes directly from a scene in the book, All Quiet on the Western Front, where the Russian prisoners of war are burying one of their number. And there's a funeral, and they're singing a Russian hymn. And there's a description of one of them playing the violin, and it's so thin, it sounds frozen. And the idea of the sound of this violin and these Russians huddled in the mist, in the freezing mist, at this do-it-yourself funeral, I just found it very moving. So the central movement is a moment of stillness, but with a kind of agonising depth to it, this stillness. The last movement is a relentless, endless march, and it is the idea of us continuing to get into these wars over and over and over again, going round and round, and just reflecting the end of the novel, which says, fighting for what?
I find it's a silence that really upholds people, because there's no language involved, and there is the link for music for me. I work with language, I write, I talk, I've taught. To be somewhere where you can go beyond language and you don't have to find any answers, and it doesn't have to mean anything that you can put into words, I find that very liberating. And for me, music has a similar function. But the Quaker silence, what I think is really upholding to people, is that nobody has to offer answers. Maybe there are no answers. You know, for example, I think the predicament the human race finds itself in now, it's actually quite liberating to say, we can't solve this. There aren't answers. But we have to live with it. We have to deal with it. And to put that into the silence.
In the theatre, of course, if you're doing a comedy, you get people laughing, and that's wonderful. But there is a silence that can happen in the theatre if you're doing a tragedy. You know that story is being told, and you know that everybody is listening. But I mean, it is essential if you do anything very dramatic, you can tell the different sounds that an audience make or doesn't make, and you judge the performance by that. I remember when we did Macbeth, you really could, I suppose, hear a pin drop. The silence was very, very intense. And into that, you know, you dropped the words of the play. And that's thrilling when that can happen.
It, is just a very important part of spiritual life. I think everyone knows that. It's a bit of a misconception that Quakers disapprove of music. It's a complete misconception because it's regarded as something very important and spiritual. I'm just quite glad it's not actually in the meeting.
There is a moment always in a Quaker meeting when you feel the silence drops right down, drops to be something very profound. Nearly always, sometimes not, but in most cases. It's just that principle of where two or three are gathered together, and somehow sharing that quiet. There is that same feeling of listening to music and that depth of feeling that you get when listening to some music. And there is something very, very profound in the listening of music and the listening in a silent room with a lot of people. I think they're very similar.
Quakers Don't Sing was produced in Glasgow by Lindsay Pell. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Penny Gore, for the second part of tonight's Choral Prom, live on BBC Radio 3 and online at bbc.co.uk/proms, where you can listen in extra high-quality HD sound, as well as checking out interviews, a daily proms music guide, and the complete programme book for this concert, in which Paul McCreesh is conducting the Gabrielli Consort and Players with four vocal soloists and additional choirs in Mendelssohn's oratorio Elijah. The choral forces are largely made up of youth choirs, which are part of the Gabrielli Young Singers Scheme, Cheetham's Chamber Choir, the Taplow Youth Choir, the North East Youth Chorale and the Ulster Youth Chamber Choir.
It's just something as I get older which becomes much, much closer to my heart. I'm really concerned that music is far too often the prerogative of a tiny proportion of society, but I want to try and do my little bit and to share what I happen to believe in. We started off working with CHETS, which, as you know, is a specialist state music school. Like many people think it's another private school, which it's not. We've now added three other choirs, all of whom are directed by really inspirational choir directors who I have such respect for. The talent to get these young singers to sing and work on a Wednesday night when it's raining in a little town near Durham. These are the real heroes of our musical world. They're not conductors or famous singers. And I hope when people listen to the quality and the energy of their amazing singing that they'll realise that for many young people, their only limitation is our lack of imagination as adults. And I want to change that. Usually with kids, they can do anything if you ask them with enough enthusiasm and enough love, and that's what I think it's all about.
Paul McCreesh. Well, we left the action at the end of part one with a huge storm invoked by Elijah to put an end to the years of drought afflicting his people. A soprano aria expresses trust in God's continuing protection at the start of part two, as Elijah prepares for another confrontation with King Ahab. And he has a second enemy plotting against him, Queen Jezebel, who accuses him of causing the famine. Paul McCreesh again.
There's something in the character of Elijah which I find immensely attractive. He isn't one of these irritating prig saints that you really want to slap and say, get real. You know, he's a man for whom the struggle to follow the right moral path is something which costs him hugely on a personal level. And I think that's a metaphor which transfers very easily into any culture at any time. And many of these concepts, he that will endure to the end, from darkness cometh light. These are at the heart of the Bible and at the heart of Christian thought. But of course, they're wonderful philosophy, which not just Christians own. And I hope for that reason it means something to everybody who takes part in this, whether they be performers, young or old, or whether they be in the audience. I think there's a tremendous modernity in this piece.
We've heard there's an enormous amount of drama in part one. It's sometimes been said that the action is in part one and you know, part two is a whole different ball game.
I find this oratorio actually very cleverly constructed. And yes, there's a a more natural, if you like, dramatic tension in part one. But the second part is by no means a letdown. There's a tremendous, almost personal breakdown where Elijah says, to paraphrase Christ later, you know, if you can take this cup away from me, he feels unworthy of his mission. And then the angel directs him to prepare himself for the arrival of God. And this extraordinary moment, which speaks to me very, very emotionally even now, that God did not come in the earthquake and the fire and the storm, but he appeared in the still small voice of calm, beautiful phrase in English. There's such a metaphor there, isn't there? That we spend our whole lives, God knows, conductors, we're the worst, aeroplanes, mobile phones, text messaging at 3 a.m, computer games, kids, Facebook. Where is the voice of calm in our lives? Perhaps this is what this oratorio tells us.
Well, so finally, renewed in hope and faith, Elijah continues his mission until the end of his days, when a fiery chariot takes him up to heaven in a whirlwind. Paul McCreesh talking about the message of Elijah. And the members of this enormous orchestra, very much expanded Gabrielli players. And the choirs, of course, not least the choirs. And I was saying earlier, what an enormous number of singers there are on stage, 300 of them, and they're ranged in various tiers, not just at the back of the stage, four rows right at the back of the stage, in a sort of formation that you might be familiar with if you've seen The Last Night of the Proms, but also in the choir stalls behind, the whole of the first tier of the choir stalls behind the stage, taken up on both sides with these young singers and an audience right up at the top, peering down in great fascination at what's going on the stage below them. And the tuning taking place is prompted by the organ of the Royal Albert Hall, this mighty instrument played by William Whitehead tonight, and the leader of the orchestra, Catherine Martin, just standing up and seeing the orchestra quiet down as it readies itself for the second part of Elijah. And the orchestral ensemble, as I said, is fairly massive, and the wind section particularly, and the brass greatly augmented. Paul McCreesh mentioned earlier some of these unusual instruments, including the Monstre Offerkleid. I'll tell you a bit more about that later, I think. And applause now for our soloists returning to the stage. Simon Keenly-Side, Sarah Connolly, Rosemary Joshua and Robert Murray, with Paul McCreesh, all taking their places for part two of Mendelssohn's Elijah.
Thank you. exalted thee from among the people, and o'er his people Israel hath made thee king. But thou, Ahab, hast done evil to provoke him to anger above all that were before thee. As if it had been a light thing for thee to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, thou hast made a grove and an altar to Baal, and served him and worshipped him. Thou hast killed the righteous and also taken possession, and the Lord shall smite all Israel as a reed is shaken in the water, and he shall give Israel up, and thou shalt know he is the Lord.
Prophesied against all Israel. that Jezebel, Elijah, is worthy to die. So the mighty gather against thee, and they have prepared a net for thy steps, that they may seize thee, that they may slay thee. Arise, then, arise, and hasten for thy life to the wilderness journey. The Lord thy God hath called us with thee. He will not fail thee, he will not forsake thee. Now be gone and bless me. And bless me also for Strigen. They have not grieved. Tarry here, my servant. The Lord be with thee. I journey.
Slain all thy prophets, slain them with the sword, and slain. Lift thine eyes, O Lord. my strength, have spent my strength for naught. Oh, that thou wouldst rend the heavens, that thou wouldst come down, that the mountains would flow down at thy presence, to make thy name known to thine adversaries, through the wonders of thy works.
Thank you.
Shall the righteous shine forth?
Lord, our Creator, how excellent thy name is in all the nations. Mendelssohn's Elijah coming to a joyful conclusion to a great roar of acclaim from the audience at the Royal Albert Hall. While Paul McCreesh delved back into the performance history of this choral titan to bring us his vision of how it might have sounded over 150 years ago. With a greatly expanded orchestra, the Gabrielli players replicating the huge size of the original ensemble. And the singers of the Gabrielli Consort singing alongside the Wrocław Philharmonic Choir from Poland and the four groups taking part in the Gabrielli Youth Singers Scheme, the Taplow Youth Choir, the Ulster Youth Chamber Choir, the Cheatham's Chamber Choir and the Northeast Youth Chorale. And incidentally, Paul McCreesh was very particular at rehearsal that the singers should be standing on the platform, not in their respective groups, but all mingling and working together as one mighty ensemble, all learning from one another, and they've done, I'm sure you'll agree, a superb job tonight. You will have heard that huge roar of approval from the audience a couple of moments ago. Well, that was when all the members of this mighty massed choral ensemble rose to their feet. And that great big cheer for the young treble, Jonty Ward, coming back on stage. We heard him in part one as the young boy eagerly scanning the horizons at Elijah's urging to see if the storm was coming that would end the drought. And here's Paul McCreesh back on stage with his four soloists. Simon Keenleyside singing the role of Elijah, Robert Murray, Rosemary Joshua and Sarah Connolly. Sarah Connolly, in fact, will be back here exactly a week today, and she'll be performing in Beethoven's Missa Solemnis. And an extra cheer there for the solo singers who stepped out from the chorus: Susan Gilmore Bailey, Emily Rowley Jones, Lucy Ballard, Ruth Gibbons, Samuel Bowden, Richard Roundtree, Robert Davis and William Gaunt. And Paul McCreesh bowing low. I mentioned a bit earlier those unusual instruments. Anthony George playing the contrabass ophicleide. And now the normal ophicleides are not dissimilar in shape to, I suppose, tubas that have been on a very drastic diet. But the contrabass or monstre ophicleide is absolutely enormous. Has to be transported in a box that's 7 feet long. And Anthony George was telling me earlier that it weighs in at 57 kilos. And if you straightened it out, it's in a lot of very sinuous curves, it would be 15 feet long. Quite a sight to see. And not forgetting the three serpents, one of them is played by Carl Woodcroft, and he was telling me it comes from the Bates collection at Oxford University. Made in 1800, the date's engraved on the instrument, and it was a military instrument designed to be played on horseback. And if the battle got very heated, it could also come in handy as a weapon, apparently. And Paul McCreesh returning this great project of his, so dear to his heart, and urging the chorus masters to come on stage. They've done a fantastic job with these choirs assembled tonight. Gillian Dibdin is the chorus master of the Taplow Youth Choir, Greg Beardsall from the Ulster Youth Chamber Choir, Martin Bussey from Cheatham's Chamber Choir, and John Forsyth from the Northeast Youth Chorale. And of course the Wrocław Philharmonic Choir, appearing in association with the Polish Cultural Institute and European Commission. Their chorus master is Agnieszka Frankow-Zelazny. And Paul McCreesh asking William Whitehead to take his solo bow. He's perched up at the organ here at the Royal Albert Hall, producing a tremendous volcanic sound here. And solo bow for those serpent players. They're right at the back to the right of the choir. And the soloists making their way back on stage now. A tremendous ovation and a last bringing of everyone to their feet from Paul McCreesh, who's been tireless today. He was here before rehearsals began on the stage, going around talking to everybody, even adjusting chairs, getting everything in place, and he's been working like a whirlwind all day. And he's going to lead them after this in a recording of the piece, and there's not much of a rest for them because they're back tomorrow morning to begin their rehearsals for the recording. Well, here at the Royal Albert Hall, are from tomorrow night is a very different story. Hooray for Hollywood, with John Wilson leading his own orchestra and the Maida Vale Singers. That's at 7:30 tomorrow. But for now, it's time to say goodbye from the Royal Albert Hall. And Jill Anderson will continue Radio 3 Sunday night. I'll return you to her in the studio at Broadcasting House.
Thank you very much, Penny. That was Penny Gore at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Tuesday afternoon, just after 2:30 here on Radio 3. Well, Words and Music is at 10:15 this evening. Greta Scacchi and Simon Woods read poetry and prose on the theme of the exotic. But now let's hear music by a composer about whom Mendelssohn said, "I think him the most promising young musician I know." He was William Sterndale Bennett, born in 1816 in Sheffield. He was a boy chorister at King's College in Cambridge and went on to study at the newly formed Royal Academy of Music in London at the age of only 10. Mendelssohn was present at a concert Sterndale Bennett gave of his own piano concerto, which took place at Windsor Castle in front of the King and Queen. And Mendelssohn invited Sterndale Bennett to Germany, and he made his first trip there in 1836. Bennett, now 20 years old, played his third piano concerto at the Gewandhaus, and the fourth concerto was played there the next year. Sterndale Bennett was teaching by then at the Royal Academy of Music, and in 1856 he became Professor of Music at Cambridge and Principal of the Academy 10 years later. So why is it that such a successful and admired composer's music fell out of favour? Well, it's partly that his piano music followed the rather English reserved style, as opposed to the flamboyant pieces by Liszt that were being written at about the same time, and partly that he didn't seem to have enough confidence in his own abilities. Well, we're here now, the Sonata Duo in A for cello and piano, which was given its first performance in London in 1852. Here to play it are the cellist George Curtez and the pianist Kalman Druffy. Two movements from William Sterndale Bennett's Sonata Duo in A, Opus 32, and they were played by George Curtes and Kalman Druffy. Now, a romance for piano by Sterndale Bennett. This is the first of three romances, Opus 14, and it's played by Ilona Prunyi. William Sterndale Bennett's Romance, Opus 14, No. 1, was played by Ilona Prunyi. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 10:15. Time now for Words and Music. The theme for this week's sequence of poetry, prose and music is The Exotic. The readers are Greta Scacchi and Simon Woods. During the programme, we'll be hearing words by Byron, Kipling and Maya Angelou, with music by Berlioz, Mozart, Messiaen and Purcell. We begin with Saint-Saëns' Bacchanal from his opera Samson and Delilah.
The barge she sat in, like a burnished throne, burned on the water. The poop was beaten gold, purple the sails, and so perfumed that the winds were lovesick with them. The oars were silver, which to the tune of flutes kept stroke, and made the water which they beat to flow faster, as amorous of their strokes. And for her own person, it beggared all description. She did lie in her pavilion, cloth of gold of tissue, o'er-picturing that Venus where we see the fancy outwork nature. On each side her stood pretty dimpled boys, like smiling cupids, with divers coloured fans, whose wind did seem to glow the delicate cheeks which they did cool, and what they undid, did. Her gentlewomen, like the Nereides, so many mermaids, tended her in the eyes, and made their bends adornings. At the helm, a seeming mermaid steers. The silken tackles swell with the touches of those flower-soft hands that yearly frame the office. From the barge, a strange invisible perfume hits the sense of the adjacent wharfs. The city cast her people out upon her, and Antony, enthroned in the marketplace, did sit alone, whistling to the air, which, but for vacancy, had gone to gaze on Cleopatra too, and made a gap in nature.
Oh, never talk again to me of northern climes and British ladies. It has not been your lot to see, like me, the lovely girl of Cadiz. Although her eye be not of blue, nor fair her locks like English lasses, how far its own expressive hue the languid azure eye surpasses. Prometheus-like, from heaven she stole the fire, that through those silken lashes in darkest glances seems to roll from eyes that cannot hide their flashes. And as along her bosom steal, in lengthened flow her raven tresses, you'd swear each clustering lock could feel and curl to give her neck caresses. Our English maids are long to woo, and frigid even in possession, and if their charms be fair to view, their lips are slow at love's confession. But, born beneath a brighter sun, for love ordained the Spanish maid is, and who, when fondly fairly won, enchants you like the girl of Cadiz.
Night, the black summer, simplifies her smells into a village. She assumes the impenetrable musk of the negro, grows secret as sweat, her alleys odorous with shucked oyster shells, coals of gold oranges, braziers of melon. Commerce and tambourines increase her heat, hellfire or the whorehouse, crossing Park Street, a surf of sailors' faces, crest is gone with the sea's phosphorescence. The boîte de nuit tinkle like fireflies in her thick hair. Blinded by headlamps, deaf to taxi klaxons, she lifts her face from the cheap pitch oil flare towards stars, like cities, flashing neon, burning to be the bitch she must become. As daylight breaks, the coolie turns his tumbril of hacked beheaded coconuts towards home.
Be not afeard. The isle is full of noises, sounds and sweet airs that give delight and hurt not. Sometimes a thousand twangling instruments will hum about mine ears, and sometimes voices that, if I then had waked after long sleep, will make me sleep again, and then, in dreaming, the clouds methought would open and show riches ready to drop upon me that, when I waked, I cried to dream again.
Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain, in what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry?
Thank you.
Byzantium. The unpurged images of day recede. The emperor's drunken soldiery are abed. Night resonance recedes. Nightwalker's song after great cathedral gong. A starlit or a moonlit dome disdains all that man is, all mere complexities, the fury and the mire of human veins. Before me floats an image, man or shade, shade more than man, more image than a shade. For Hades, bobbin bound in mummy cloth, may unwind the winding path. A mouth that has no moisture and no breath, breathless mouths may summon. I hail the superhuman. I call it death in life and life in death. Miracle, bird or golden handiwork, more miracle than bird or handiwork, planted on the starlit golden bough, can like the cocks of Hades crow, or, by the moon embittered, scorn aloud in glory of changeless metal, common bird or petal, and all complexities of mire or blood. At midnight on the emperor's pavement flit flames no faggot feeds, nor steel has lit, nor storm disturbs, flames begotten of flame, where blood-begotten spirits come, and all complexities of fury leave, dying into a dance, an agony of trance, an agony of flame that cannot singe a sleeve. A straddle on the dolphin's mire and blood, spirit after spirit. The smithies break the flood, the golden smithies of the emperor. Marbles of the dancing floor break bitter furies of complexity, those images that yet fresh images beget, that dolphin-torn, that gong-tormented sea.
Φασδανό τελαμόνι
On we went again, into the silence, along empty reaches, round the still bends, between the high walls of our winding way, reverberating in hollow claps the ponderous beat of the stern wheel. Trees, trees, millions of trees. Massive, immense, running up high, and at their foot, hugging the bank against the stream, crept the little, begrimed steamboat, like a sluggish beetle crawling along the floor of a lofty portico. We penetrated deeper and deeper into the heart of darkness. It was very quiet there. At night, sometimes, the roll of drums behind the curtain of trees would run up the river and remain sustained faintly, as if hovering in the air high over our heads, till the first break of day. Whether it meant war, peace, or prayer, we could not tell. But suddenly, as we struggled round a bend, there would be a glimpse of rush walls, of peaked grass roofs, a burst of yells, a whirl of black limbs, a mass of hands clapping, of feet stamping, of bodies swaying, of eyes rolling under the droop of heavy and motionless foliage.
Generations of monkeys had been scared into good behaviour by the stories their elders told them of Kaa, the night thief, who could slip along the branches as quietly as moss grows and steal away the strongest monkey that ever lived. Of old Kaa, who could make himself look so like a dead branch or a rotten stump that the wisest were deceived, till the branch caught them. Kaa was everything that the monkeys feared in the jungle, for none of them knew the limits of his power. None of them could look him in the face, and none had ever come alive out of his hug. And so they ran, stammering with terror, to the walls and the roofs of the houses, and Baloo drew a deep breath of relief. Then Kaa opened his mouth for the first time and spoke one long, hissing word, and the faraway monkeys stayed where they were, cowering till the loaded branches bent and cracked under them.
Now I'm the king of the swingers, oh, the jungle VIP. I've reached the top and had to stop, and that's what's bothering me. I want to be a man cub, and stroll right into town, and be just like the other men. I'm tired of mugging around. Oh, ooby-doo, I want to be like you. I want to walk like you, talk like you. You'll see it's true. An ape like me can learn to be human too.
Made a deal with you. What I desire is man's red fire to make my dream come true. Now give me the secret, man cub. Come on, clue me what to do. Give me the power of man's red flower so I can be like you.
Ooh, 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 ooh,
la ha 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 ha.